a part in helping to build the temple. Who are these people? They could be Samaritans, which would be another way of saying that they are who? Yeah, sort of quasi-Gentiles. The way that they are described in chapter 4 and verse 1 is they are adversaries. And then later on, they are described basically as in verse 4, the people of the land. So we surmised on Sunday's class that there's a good chance that these are the people described in 2 Kings chapter 17. After northern Israel is carried off into exile, the Assyrians, they had a very harsh policy of basically bringing foreign captives in and settling them and taking the native peoples out. That way it would dilute the patriotic, nationalistic fervor of the captured captive population. So the resultant intermingling of these peoples creates the race that eventually we come to know as the Samaritans, but is it really a racial thing that's at issue here in Ezra 4 that we studied on Sunday? It's not really a racial thing. It's a religious thing. And in fact, we even noticed in 2 Kings chapter 17 that the text is very clear that when these people kind of got all enmeshed, it does say they were interested in worshiping the Lord, but how did they worship him? Yeah, mixed up with all their gods from back where they were from. It's kind of like driving here in Florida, because you've got the native Floridian population, and then you've got people from everywhere else around the country, and they all have their own peculiar ways of driving, and they just all get slammed together right here in Florida. So you just never know, every four-way stop, it's just Russian roulette, you know. Well, so yeah, you've got these foreigners, and yeah, they're willing to say, sure, we'll worship your God. He can just be one more on the list. One more on the group of gods that we've come to worship. And of course, the people of the return are sensitive to this because, after all, why did they end up in exile in the first place? For mixing the worship of the one true God with idols. So who wants to go down that road again? So that's the idea here in Ezra chapter 4. And nevertheless, the effort to stop the work in its tracks is successful, because these adversaries send word to the Persian king and the governors, and what do they basically say? What's going to happen if this work is able to continue? Yeah, it's just a rebellion is about to foment. And then, if you remember, in Ezra 4, Ezra, the writer of the book, says, and that's just like this other time when it happened, and it's just like this other time when it happened. This is what always happens. There are always these efforts to stir up trouble and accuse us. And of course, to some extent, the accusations are legitimate because Jerusalem did have a history of rebellion. But anyway, the bottom line of this is that the work comes to a screeching halt. All right. Well, so at this point, I wanted to pause and go back and review the first few chapters to get those of you who have not been in this class, particularly our college students, who are now coming in this class, so that you'll be on the same page with us about what we're looking at. Now, it just so happens that those of you who are going to Florida College, I know you have a class on Old Testament history and geography, and if you are like my students, I'm sure you remember every single thing that you were taught. So this is just a perfunctory review of Old Testament history, but you remember that the way things unfold is there are three steps to the captivity. And those steps begin when King Nebuchadnezzar takes Daniel and his three friends as royal hostages. That's step one right here. And then step number two is when Jehoiakim rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. By the way, that's one of these rebellions that would be in the royal records that when they want to later accuse Jerusalem of always being rebellious, they can point to. He dies, his son Jehoiachin becomes king just in time to be carried off with several thousand others. That's this step right here. And then the third and most devastating of all is when the city of Jerusalem is destroyed, the temple is destroyed, the articles of the temple are carried off, The king Zedekiah is carried off in chains, and it looks as if the house of God and the house of David are both kaput. And we know from Jeremiah, who was prophesying around this time, how long is this captivity going to last? Yeah, 70 years. If you didn't know anything, you could probably guess numbers, and you'd have a pretty fair shot at coming up with 70, because it's such a key number in the Bible. So yeah, they're going to be in Babylonian exile for 70 years. Now then, this is all going to change when Babylon is no longer in control of things. It's the Babylonian exile. When the Babylonians are overthrown, it's going to change. And that happens in the year 539. You remember the famous story in the book of Daniel when the last king, Belshazzar, sees the handwriting on the wall. And it means you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And so the Persians do indeed come and overthrow and conquer Babylon with their king Cyrus. So that's going to mark now the end of this 70 years. And then what's going to happen is the return from captivity is also going to happen in three phases. And the three phases of this return are going to span the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which we are studying. The content of those books is going to describe for us these three phases of the return. So what's going to happen is, if you look back in Ezra chapter 1, the new Persian king, Cyrus, at the end of this 70 years, becomes king, and he issues an edict, which has been preserved for us in this artifact called the Cyrus Cylinder. And you can see the biblical version of it here in Ezra 1 and verse 2, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, and so forth. This was standard Persian policy. If you look at the text of the inscription, Cyrus brags. He says, I return to these sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries which have been ruins for a long time, the images which used to live therein and establish for them. Of course, in the case of the Jews, there are no images, but there are lampstands and altars and things like that, all the furnishings of the temple that are going to be returned. So then when we come to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, these books were originally one big book. They've been divided out for us, but they were originally one big book. And what these books are going to cover is the different phases of this return. So what's going to happen is phase one is going to have to do with the temple. And that's what Ezra chapters 1 through 6 are all about. So that's where we are right now. We've been studying in this section of Ezra all that's going to take place, and there's actually a lot that's going to take place with the temple. So when you look at the first 6 chapters of Ezra, it's going to talk about the return of the exiles to build the temple. Then the second phase of the return is going to happen when they rebuild the law. And that's going to be the work of Ezra. And that's Ezra 7 through 10. And then the third and final phase is going to come in the time of Nehemiah when they rebuild the walls. Although there's going to be a lot more to it than just simply building walls. The people need more work than the walls do. And that's what all the rest of the books of Nehemiah and Ezra are going to be about. So I wanted you to kind of see the big picture of where we are in Bible history and also where we are here in the book of Ezra. So here's what happens. Cyrus issues this order. Hey, you can go back home and you can rebuild the temple. And he issues that order in 538. Cyrus issues the decree. And a couple years later, by 535, the foundation is built. Now, Colleen, you've got this all mapped out, right, for when we have the new building, and I'm going to have a lavish whiteboard, and it's not going to be awkward, and we can all see everything, right? You've got this all figured out.
I have to talk to the audiovisual committee.
Yeah, all right, committee, so let's get out of here, okay? All right, so this is what's happened. But then, as we just said, screeching halt. At the end of chapter 4, this work comes to a screeching halt. So what we're going to study tonight is what happens to enable that work to once again get started. So if you look at the very end of chapter 4 and verse 24 of Ezra, the text says, "Then the work on the house of God that is in Jerusalem stopped, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia." Well, that doesn't help me. If only I had a list of the Persian kings and their dates so I can, boom, there it is, right there, just like that, at your bidding. So here's a list of the Persian kings. Cambyses, as far as I can tell, is not mentioned in the Old Testament. But we've just talked about Cyrus. And now what it's just told us is that this work on the temple is not going to resume until the second year of Darius. So what would be a ballpark date we could put down for when that is going to resume? 520. Sounds good to me. So 520, we're already being told here the work is going to resume. But we've got to see how this is actually all going to take place. So let's look here in chapter 5, in verse 1. Who shows up and becomes a catalyst to get this work on its way? Yes, Haggai and Zechariah. So I think it's always important to remember that the way the Bible is laid out is not necessarily chronological. Now, of course, Genesis through Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther is more or less, you know, chronological. But then you've got the Psalms. Well, they intersperse all in through there, right? The time, one of them is written by Moses, Psalm 90. And then you've got a lot of them, of course, by David. And then some by Solomon, etc. And then you've got the Proverbs of Solomon and Hezekiah. And then you've got the prophetic books. And these prophetic books are all interspersed all through these periods of Bible history. Before the exile, during the exile, and after the exile. In fact, sometimes when you study the prophets, like Nathan has taught for us Amos and Hosea, those prophets are usually called pre-exilic. Guess why? You'd never believe it. They are before the exile. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel are called exilic prophets. Take a wild guess, because they prophesied during the exile. And then, the big three, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, guess what they're called? You'll just never guess. Post-exilic. That's exactly right. Just simply meaning that they prophesy after the exile. And so they're mentioned here. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. By the way, that's a neat little editorial comment, isn't it? In the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Because on the surface, from a human point of view, who does it look like is over the people of Israel? Yeah, Cyrus or Darius or one of the Persian monarchs. So this is the Bible's way of, you know, not so subtly reminding us, hey, look, Cyrus, Darius, these guys, they're not in charge. They are simply instruments or servants. God is the one who is in charge. Now, I thought it might do us some good tonight to pause and to go back and look at these books. Mainly Haggai, because it's so short, but just to take a look and see what's going on and what information we can find that will supplement what we're reading here in Ezra. So hold your place here, and let's go over to the book of Haggai. Haggai chapter 1. In the second year of Darius. Now remember, that's the year that we were just told that's when things are going to, you know, start back up. So in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, on the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet, and then we meet a couple of familiar figures, don't we? Who's mentioned here in Haggai? Zerubbabel. And who is Zerubbabel? which tells you even right here. And it's cheating, right? Yeah, it says it right there. He's the governor. And Joshua, and who is Joshua? Yeah, so same two guys we've seen mentioned several times already back in Ezra. All right, verse 2. Thus says the Lord of hosts, these people say the time has not yet come to rebuild the house of the Lord. Then the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet. Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses while this house lies in ruins? Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. So what apparently had gone on in addition to the interference of others? But, you know, that interference, if you look at these dates here, it's been 15 years since trouble was stirred up. A lot can change. Think about how things politically in our country change within a 15-year span of time. So a lot of things could have potentially changed. Why haven't they changed? Well, I'm sure there's a lot of factors, but now Haggai has told us what one of those factors is, and what is it? That's exactly right. They've become preoccupied with, you know, renovating their homes and not working on the house of God. So remember, what was the reaction back in Ezra 3 when the foundation was completed? Back in, you know, like around 535, we ballparked it at. What was their reaction? Yeah, it was overwhelmingly emotional. That'd be the way to capture it all, right? And then as you all say, some, you know, were just tearful because it's just not as good as the old one. And some were overcome with joy because isn't this great? But yeah, the point is there was a lot of feeling, a lot of passion, either way, as they see the foundation of the temple built. But apparently, that's waned. And maybe, you know, sometimes, think about it in life. How many times do you have a goal? This happens, I bet, a lot, people who want to work out. Although, you know, it's kind of funny this year, and I know a few of y'all go to the Y, I didn't see nearly the New Year's Eve people, I mean the New Year's resolution people this year. Like usually it's jam-packed the first few days and then it tapers back off and they get, you know, just whittled right down. But it was like they just said from the get-go, I'm not even going to try this year. It just seems like it. Anyway. But you know, you'll make a go, I'm going to go work out 5 days a week. And the first week goes great and then the second week you get a cold. And you just really can't. You can't breathe. So you're kind of laid out. So you've had some, you know, adversity. And then what happens? Well, you just can't get back into it. So, you know, maybe there's a combination of factors here. You know, they've had this opposition. Now, that's been a long time. But maybe that opposition was enough to take the wind out of their sails to want to do this work of rebuilding. And then they kind of get focused on other priorities. That ever happened in your life? You just kind of get caught up in the hustle and bustle of things that they're not even necessarily bad. It's just that they're things that preoccupy your time and you don't think about the Lord and you don't think about the work of the Lord. So that's how I kind of see this first chapter here. And so in verse 7, what does the Lord say through Haggai? Consider your ways. Go up to the hills and bring wood and build the house that I may take pleasure in it and I may be glorified, says the Lord. You looked for much and behold, it came to little. And when you brought it home, I blew it away. Why, declares the Lord of hosts, because of my house that lies in ruins while each of you busies himself with his own house. And then the Lord even says, you know, I have withheld rain right now as a punishment for how you're acting. And so in verse 12, then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, did what? They obey the voice of the Lord. And so it says at the verse 14, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and worked on the house of the Lord of hosts, their God, on the 24th day of the month, in the sixth month, in the second year. So remember, the word of the Lord came to him, according to verse 1, on the first day of the sixth month, and now 3 weeks later, see that? On the 24th day of the sixth month, they get to work. That's pretty good results, right? 3 weeks of preaching, and now the people are stirred back up into carrying on the work of the Lord. And so we said, you know, if you look at Darius, second year, approximately, we sort of say these dates are always approximate because there's some overlapping years here and there, but approximately 520. So that means 15 years after the foundation was laid, then the brakes were put on it. Now 15 years later, that work is going to resume. Now, the other prophet, of course, who's active is just right next door here, Zechariah. Won't read much from him. I'll just remind you of the first few verses here. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, son of Iddo, saying, "The Lord was very angry with your fathers. Therefore say to them, thus declares the Lord of hosts, return to me, says the Lord of hosts, and I will return to you, says the Lord." So don't be like your fathers. Be obedient to me. Zechariah, much longer book, a lot more visions to it. But anyway, I just wanted you to see that while Zerubbabel and Joshua are at work, that you've also got, and I'll just put the letters H and Z, to remind us that there's also prophets at work. Just like there were prophets at work over here, like Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, and now there's prophets at work over here as well. All right, so with that little detour in place, let's go back over here to Ezra chapter 5. So the first few verses mention our two prophets here, Haggai and Zechariah. But do you think this work is just going to start back up willy-nilly without any problems, any hiccups whatsoever? Well, of course not. There's always going to be a hiccup of some kind. So look at verse 3. At the same time, Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river. So what's the river that's being talked about here? Yeah, that's exactly right. I think I've got the map up right here. So yeah, you see the Tigris and the Euphrates River. So beyond the river, from the Persian point of view, that's basically all the territory from the Euphrates west, which of course includes Jerusalem. So this guy is the governor of that whole region. So he's responsible for what goes on in it. And his little right-hand man here, Shethar-Bozenai, and their associates came to them and spoke to them thus. And what do they want to know? Yeah. So, you know, it's like in my HOA community, you can't even build a shed in your backyard unless you get permission, some kind of variance. It's a terrible regime we live under here. And Mrs. Scott and I were canceled each other's votes out because she was firmly against permission to build. And when they did the permission, she wasn't around, and I signed it to say we can. So she never forgave me for that. But anyway, so if you can't even build a shed in your backyard in your HOA, imagine trying to build a big temple when you're not even in charge. You know, you're under your foreign overlords. So old Tattenai says, "Well, who told you you could do this? Who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure?" They also ask them this: "What are the names of the men who are building this building?" Now, here's what's interesting. It just so happens we have a very convenient list of these names, don't we? Where is it? Chapter 2. Yeah, and in fact, it may very well be that the material we know as chapter 2 actually began as the census of the workers coming back. So then it's put in here so that we understand when he wants to know. It's all on the up and up. See, look, we've got it in writing right here. So they want to know who this is. Now, look at what verse 5 tells us. Here you've got, seems like, oh boy, this is going to be another headache. But what does verse 5 tell us? And why doesn't it stop him? Yeah, now, normally the Bible talks about the eyes, plural, of the Lord. You know, the Lord's over. But every now and then, you'll see my Bible has some cross-references to some psalms, for instance, which talk about the eye of the Lord. And it's just another way of saying what? Yeah, God's looking out for them. God is the one who's in control here. He is the one who is going to look out for them to make sure this happens. So the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report should reach Darius, and then an answer be returned by a letter concerning it. So in other words, what's going to happen is Tattenai, the governor, is going to send a letter to Darius. That's going to take some time for in the ancient world for a messenger to get all the way back to the palace in Babylon. And he's going to inquire, now, who gave these people the right to do this? Now, that's what the rest of this chapter is going to describe for us. This is a copy of the letter that Tattenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar-Bozenai and his associates, the governors who were in the province beyond the river, sent to Darius the king. They sent him a report in which was written as follows. Dear Darius, to Darius the king, all peace. Be it known to the king that we went to the province of Judah, to the house of the great God. And the fact is, when you look at some of these Persian records, that's how they talk about whatever language the native nation used of its deity, that's what they use. Because as we've already talked about, that's kind of their policy. As long as you don't cause any trouble, you can worship whoever you want to. What do we see at the end of verse 8? Right, there's an indication here that the work has certainly accelerated, because what does it say at the end of verse 8? Yeah, it's being built with huge stones and timber is laid in the walls. This work goes on diligently and prospers in their hands. So back in chapter 3, the foundation was laid, but now they're framing it out and they're starting to, we would say hang sheetrock or whatever, that's pretty much the extent of my building knowledge right there. But the ancient equivalent, the point is, these guys are saying not only are they building, they're really starting to make some progress here. So if they're not supposed to be doing this, in other words, we need to know about it. Verse 9, then we asked those elders and spoke to them thus, who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure? We also asked them for their names for your information, that we might write down the names of their leaders. And this was their reply to us. We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we are rebuilding the house that was built many years ago, which a great king of Israel built and finished. And who, of course, is that king? Yeah, Solomon. Now, that gives me a point here to remind you of something to look for as we go from chapter 5 to chapter 6. Do you remember when we talked about the return of the people in chapter 2, that the way the biblical historian describes the return of the people in chapter 2 is intentionally framed to sound a lot like what? The Exodus. That's exactly right. In fact, one of the details that hopefully will stick out to you is to remember that the people who were non-Israelites give them silver and gold stuff to go take back to rebuild the temple, just like in the case of the book of Exodus, they were given silver and gold stuff to go and when they leave the land of Egypt. That's exactly right. So now, if that's the case, then what do you suppose, having just read this verse, what do you suppose will be true of the way the rebuilding of the temple is described? That's exactly right. When we get to chapter 6 especially, you're going to see that the details and nuances that are brought out to describe the reconstruction of the temple is going to play right off of either the construction of Solomon's temple or the original construction of the tabernacle itself, just to kind of tie into these previous moments in Bible history. I'm sorry some of our students were late tonight, because as you can see, I was pulling out all the stops tonight. I mean, maps, slides, whiteboard, the whole nine yards, and it was like wasted on Jackson for the most part, looks like here. So sorry about that. But anyway, all right, so I interrupted the response. Remember what's going on here in Ezra 5. We're at verse 12. The Jews had stopped building the temple. They have resumed building it through the leadership of Haggai and Zechariah the prophets. The governor of the province says, well, wait a minute, who told you could do that? Says, give me the names, give me the evidence that you've got permission. And now he's sending a message to the king in Persia, Darius. Hey, I want you to know what's going on here, and we're not sure they're supposed to do this. Now, when we investigated, they said, oh, yeah, we're allowed to do this. So right now, we're relating his recounting of the response of the people of Israel. So chapter 5, verse 12. But because our fathers had angered the God of heaven, he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed this house and carried away the people to Babylonia. Now, again, remember, we talked about this from the very first class. Bible history is interpretive. This isn't just a history textbook. It's much, much more than that. It's preaching from history. And from a historian's point of view, if you had a textbook on ancient Near Eastern history, when you got to the 6th century BC, it would say that the nation of Judah was captured and conquered by Babylon because of Nebuchadnezzar's military machine. That's what secular history would say. But Bible history is interpreted. So it's actually going to interpret, as the people do here, let me tell you the real reason this happened. The real reason, theologically, is that in verse 12, our fathers angered God. And so he permitted this to take place. All right, verse 13. However, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, Cyrus the king made a decree that this house of God should be rebuilt. Decree back in chapter 1. And the gold and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought into the temple at Babylon, these Cyrus the king took out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered. So remember, even on the Cyrus cylinder, he was bragging that he allowed the nations to have their own idols to go back into their temple. And so, as I said, in the case of the people of Jerusalem, there aren't going to be any idols. They're going to be sent back because they didn't have any. But all the other stuff, all this stuff that's mentioned right here in verse 14, that's the stuff that he's going to say can be sent back. If you look there at the end of verse 14, we have a name come back up that we haven't seen in a while. What is that name? Yeah, that Sheshbazzar, however you're supposed to say that, who apparently was a governor prior to Zerubbabel. He's the guy mentioned back in chapters 1 and 2. So, verse 15. And he said to them, take these vessels and go and put them in the temple that's in Jerusalem and let the house of God be rebuilt on its site. Then this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God that is in Jerusalem. And from that time until now, it has been in building and it is not yet finished. Foundation, as we said, laid in 535. So verse 17, therefore, if it seems good to the king, let search be made in the royal archives there in Babylon to see whether a decree was issued by Cyrus the king for the rebuilding of this house of God in Jerusalem, and let the king send us his pleasure in this matter. So it's going to be a cliffhanger now, because we may run out of time tonight. So what will the answer be? What will the king find when he searches the royal annals? Well, I want to talk about that. We might get to the first few verses of the next chapter. But I wanted to pause, first of all, any questions on how things are developing here? Anything you want me to go back over? Yeah, Ms. Irma? Well, the last I saw, it was being wheeled into a giant warehouse in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. I think with a bunch of other stuff, UFO stuff and things like that. But that's always the $64 question, isn't it? The text keeps talking about the vessels, you know, the gold and silver vessels and so forth. And I don't know. If I had to speculate, I would assume that some of that stuff was chopped up, destroyed, searched. There's a lot of things in archaeology have been destroyed because treasure hunters thought that there was something inside something and break it open, and then they destroy it. So I don't know. The absence of the ark is very conspicuous, though, isn't it? And in fact, even in the book of Haggai, when, you know, he urges them to get on with rebuilding the temple, he seems to indicate that the glory, the ultimate glory of the Lord isn't going to be here yet. There's going to be a future glory to come. So I think that the best way to answer your question is, I think even the Jews themselves recognized that with the rebuilding of this temple, there was something profoundly inferior and something missing. So yeah, certainly in the big picture, I think you're right. They are aware that this isn't going to be as glorious. You know, Solomon's temple, I mean, it's almost described as a house of gold. You know, and this isn't going to be quite like that. You know, even when King Herod the Great builds the magnificent temple that he built, because he was such a morally compromised person, in a lot of ways, I don't think they even, you know, held it in the same regard. But no, that's a really good question. I always wonder the same thing. So, yeah. Yes. So, Miss Martha just asked about what about the vision of the glory of the Lord leaving the most holy place and departing from the temple. Anybody remember what book of the Bible that's in? Yeah, it's in Ezekiel. And Ezekiel has this vision in which he sees the glory of God leave the most holy place. And then it goes, I think, to the eastern gate. And then it goes across the valley up onto what we would call the Mount of Olives. And that's symbolizing God leaving, you know, deserting, abandoning this temple. And I think that kind of ties into Miss Irma's question about there's no record of that glory ever coming back. Yeah. And in fact, Jesus seems to play off of that, because where does he give his famous prophecy about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? Where is he? Sometimes it's called the Olivet Discourse. Why? He leaves the temple, goes across the Kidron Valley, goes up on top of the Mount of Olives and says, your house is left unto you desolate. Almost as if he's reenacting that scene in Ezekiel. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a very good observation to tie into this sermon. Yeah. All right, any other questions or comments, observations to make? Yeah, Carl? Yes. Yeah, it's very ironic. You know, we've pointed out a lot in the Gospel of John, especially that John uses this imagery of Jesus is the temple, you know, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. So yeah, it's rich with irony, actually. Yeah, very, very good point. Let me ask you this question. I was thinking about this this afternoon. How would you describe the Jewish elders here, how would you describe their interaction with these pagan authorities? How would you describe it? All right, now I'm curious why you would say that, Dave. In what sense do you think it would be controversial? Yes, so I think certainly on the one hand you have a lot of pushback from maybe what you might call the mid-level people and the non-Israelites in the area. So you definitely have a lot of pushback, so there's a lot of controversy. How else would you picture what's being described for us here? Yeah, what's also interesting is when it comes to the head honcho, Darius and Cyrus, you actually see a very submissive posture here. In other words, the people don't say, why do we need Cyrus's permission? They're actually quite careful to follow the law and show that they actually have the decree and the permission to do this. And yet, on the other hand, they're also very clear about who the ultimate authority is, right? I mean, they say, who's the one who ultimately put us into captivity? God did that, and he's the one who's going to get us out. So I think it's very interesting for us as Christians, We are described in the New Testament as aliens, sojourners, exiles. To think about, that's very much what the New Testament says about what our response is to the government. On the one hand, we should be respectful, submissive, obey the authorities. And yet at the same time, we also need to recognize who is the ultimate authority. And that, of course, is the Lord. And strike that proper balance of respectful submission while also maintaining our commitment, first and foremost, to Christ. And I think you actually see that work itself out even in all these exchanges that are taking place here. Yeah, I'm sorry, Dave, you had your hand up. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right.
They were there all
this period of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess you could say it comes out of the treasures that have been accumulated through Babylon, and then now Persia has control of it, sure. But yeah, and as we kind of talked about, that was sort of typical Persian policy. You know, the Assyrians, they were the barbarians, you know. Their way to deal with foreigners is, you know, put hooks in their nose and drag them around. The Persians, they're, hey, go back home. Here's some money. Build your temple. Just don't cause us any trouble, and everything will be okay. So a much different posture. But I think it is interesting. One of the things that we can reflect on a practical note is the balance of how we as Christians relate to our government and that balance of respect and submission, but also, you know, certainly ultimate conviction and commitment to Christ. I see the kids looking at you. You want me to just keep them there staring just to make them uncomfortable or tell them they can come in? So, okay. So you can come on in.